This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Mike Penna and Christina McManigal.
Hey everyone, welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. My name is Christina McManigal. I am here with Mike Penna. We're together again, and the show today is going to be fantastic. We get an hour with a jockey in studio, and I'm in Lexington, Kentucky, and those of you joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM 206, and you can also tune into our website on your smartphone or on your tablet with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. So let me introduce to you our guest, who has 1,647 wins, over $83 million in earnings. Horses such as Mucho Macho Man, Groupie Doll, Caleb's Posse are just a few that line up this rider's resume. I'm proud to introduce to you Rajiv Mirage.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think of the studio, man? You're the second jockey to come in studio now. Two consecutive weeks. Joe Bravo was here last week. Rajiv is here with us. What do you think?
That's a nice studio. Yeah, I'm checking out all these bobbleheads that you have here.
But we don't have a Rajiv Mirage bobblehead.
No, not yet. I'm not in that category yet to have a bobblehead, but I'm striving for that.
Have you ever had one?
No. Actually, I had a bobblehead at my wedding. My wife and I, the cake topper was a bobblehead of us.
No way.
That's the closest I've been to bobbleheads. Yeah.
Well, you need to have another one made so we can put it right here.
Yes.
Well, thank you for joining us, Rajiv. And just to start things off, we usually go kind of through your timeline of your life and your career. And so let's go back to the beginning and tell us how you grew up in Jamaica, correct?
Yes.
And tell us, what was that like?
Well, I was born in Kingston, Jamaica, into a racing family. Really, we're growing up, both my parents, on both sides of the family, they were involved in horse racing, because my father was a jockey and my mom's brother is a jockey. And all my family, growing up, our life revolved around horse racing. So from day one, I really dreamed of being a jockey growing up with the races in Jamaica. That's kind of where I got my inspiration of the industry. It's in Caymanas Park, is a racetrack in Jamaica, and going there and watching my dad ride and my family participate. And I left Jamaica when I was a teenager. At that point, my father was a trainer there, and my mom was owner of quite a few horses. And I had one sibling at the time, his Shamir Mirage, and our first horse that we had, my family had in Jamaica, his name was Rajmir, named after half of my name and my brother's name.
Wow.
Rajiv and Shamir. So that's how they got Rajmir. And he was a pretty successful horse in the country. And that was another tie into the horse racing for us. And in that point in my life, I really, really was just dreaming to be a jockey. So my mom was, I always told her I want to be a jockey, and she was always supportive, even at a young age. And she sent me to the States to grow up and finish high school, because she wanted me to follow my dream of being a jockey and not starting out in Jamaica, where the opportunities were limited. So even when I came here at a young age, 14 years old, in Florida, but the whole time in my mind and my mom and my dad is, I'm going to be a jockey when I finish high school. But she just wanted me to complete high school. So that's when I started training to be a jockey in Florida, and then started riding when I was 18.
Did you fight her on that decision to have to finish high school? Because I'm sure at that age, we've all been there. You want to do what you want to do. You wanted to be a jockey. Was there some kickback on your part?
There was no kickback because my mom, her intent was for me to finish high school so that, and this is what she told me. I think now I think she manipulated me a bit. So it went, but she said, yeah, you know why you need to finish high school. So when you become a jockey and you make all that money, you'll know how to spend it. You'll know how to protect your money. Yeah. And now that I look back at it, I think she was kind of manipulating me into just finishing school.
Was she right? Did you learn your lesson?
Yeah, it was pretty good. And actually now that I'm writing and stuff, I kind of wish I had furthered my education. It's pretty hard to do to put a lot of time into being a jockey and actually attend like college or something. It wouldn't match up together because being a jockey is a lifestyle, and you have to be a jockey like a day and night with everything, you know, so it wouldn't work out. But one thing I wish and I kind of regret is not being more further in school.
Yeah, maybe going on to college.
Yeah, that sometimes I look back at it and I wish in business and stuff, because when you make money in at a young age, you can really, if you know what to do with it, you can really build up if you have the education and the knowledge to do it.
So I am fascinated, to back up really quickly, I'm fascinated about Jamaica and the racing there, and I really know nothing about it. How does that compare to the racing in the States? What's different?
There is a difference that I think. I think Jamaican racing is such a big sport there in the country, and American racing is more of a business. Okay. I think that is a significant difference, because when we were growing up in Jamaica, the money wouldn't change your life, but the passion that we show for the races would. They raced only like once or twice a week, but it's year-round racing. But the racing is something that is a really big deal for the sport of it. Like, you look forward to having your horse race against other people's horse, and jockeys and trainers and horses are celebrities in the country. As opposed to here, you have to be in the industry to actually know who Rajiv Maharaj is, or who a lot of the people that participate in the horses. Hardly I can go to where the population in America is so big, and there's a lot of places that I go, people don't even know what horse racing is.
Yeah,
they don't even know it exists. So I think because of the sport in Jamaica, everyone follows it. And they're very passionate about it. And in Jamaica, when we're growing up, we think the jockeys are the best jockeys in the world. We think our horses are the best horses in the world. We think our trainers are the best trainers in the world. So it's different.
The bobsled team, too.
And the bobsled team. I knew nothing about bobsled when I was in Jamaica. I didn't even know what Cool Runnings was until I got to America.
Was your dad a celebrity when he was a jockey?
Yeah, very popular. Very popular anywhere in the country you go. I could, you know, drop his name for anything.
I was going to ask you if that helped you. I know you were still very young at that point, but was there some of that when you were going to school in Jamaica and then your dad's such a big star? Were people looking at you going, oh my, that's your dad, Rajiv? I can't believe that's your dad.
Yeah, it would. It would, you know. So, like, if you go out to, like, say, a restaurant and stuff, and there's no table, oh, that's Mirage. Okay, you get taken care of pretty good.
It has to be like, I know someone who went to high school with Coach Calipari's son. Like, it's the same thing, you know, but over there it's so much different. It's so much bigger, I guess. And it is, we need to get it that way over here in the States.
Yeah. And I think with horse racing, it's very captivating. It's just to get it exposed to people, because once you get this sport in you, you never see people get it in and get away. You can't get away from horse racing once you get the passion for it and stuff. It's very captivating. But I think it's just to get the exposure to people that have never been involved in it. But once they get involved, there ain't no turning back.
Well, like you just touched on a minute ago, Rajiv, you can't be a jockey in this sport and do it halfway. You have to be all in, and it has to be 24/7. Like you said, you're a jockey 24/7. It's a lifestyle. This is what you do, and you have to be like that if you're going to be successful, don't you?
Yes, I would think so. If you're not turning it into a lifestyle, you might be successful, but you're shorting yourself. I think to get the full 100%, you have to approach it in that way.
I can remember last year I sent Rajiv a text because we were getting ready for a show down in Florida, and I noticed in the program there was Aubrey and Alan Mirage. There was Rico and Tony Mirage. I said, how many are there? I knew there were a lot of Parboos when I got ready for the Summit of Speed that year, and I saw all the Parboos. But Rajiv, how many Mirages are involved in horse racing here in the States?
Okay, so I'm going to make it, I'm going to make something complicated easy, right? So my parents, they have the same last name before they got married. So Mirage is, my family is two families of Mirage.
Okay.
With the same last name. And my mom has 13 brothers and sisters.
Wow.
And 13.
My dad is the only boy, but he has six sisters. This is a thing. So now I have 19 aunts and uncles. And their kids are my cousins. So you multiply, say average 3 or 4 kids, it's a big number.
Wow.
Of first cousins who I grew up with very close.
Right.
All of them. We're very tight-knit. So although a very big amount of that family, cousins and uncles, and are actually involved in horse racing. So there's all the Mirages. Cousins, uncles, brothers.
Okay, how many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have 2 brothers and 1 sister.
Okay.
So my 2 brothers, the ages are 23, 11, and my sister is 1.
Oh, wow.
Wow. That's and quite the gap.
I'm going to be 30. Yeah.
That's quite the gap. So,
spread out.
Wow. So, and your brother
Shamir
is a jockey.
Yes.
Correct. And your other brother, Christian.
Christian, yes.
Not a jockey?
No, he's 11. But
will he be a jockey?
Future jockey.
Yeah, you knew you wanted to be a jockey when you were 11.
Yes. And I, of course, at that time, and a Christian, he always wanted to be a jockey. And just the other day when we were in Dubai, I asked him if he still wants to be a jockey. And he kind of gave me like he's not sure if that's still what he wants to do.
I would think in Dubai, you would know you would want to be doing that.
he rode a camel. And I think that kind of turned him off from wanting to be a jockey. I'm not sure if that's why, but...
You rode a camel once, Christina.
I won on a camel.
Really?
I won on a camel. You should be a camel jockey.
Right, right.
Well, you know, it's funny because I remember when Sheikh Mohammed was, and he still is prominent in the sport, but when he first came onto the scene, there were so many different sheikhs that were getting involved with thoroughbred racing here in the States and buying farms. And somebody had thrown something out there on Blood Horse or someplace, and it said, know your sheikh, you know, and it had all the different sheikhs and what they did and, you know, what their actual role was, because there were so many. We should come up with a know your Mirage game. That might even be more complicated than the sheikhs.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, there's more Mirages than there are sheikhs. So you...
So I have a question. Have you ever ridden against your brother, Shamir?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, hilarious story. The first time I'm going to ride again, when we're around each other, all we do is laugh. Can't help it. It's just something. So it was a moment that we couldn't forget, because we're going into the gate at Gulfstream Park and he's to my right, and we get in the gate and we look over at each other. We just start cracking up. We just start laughing. I said, this is going to be so funny. So he was like 50-1 and I was 3-1. I said, I can't let him beat me because I would never hear the end of it. And it so happened that this 3-1 was kind of running like a 50-1. So I'm like, oh my God, the one horse, if I got to beat, I got to beat this Shamir because I would never hear the end of it. But I ended up finishing in front of him. So that was okay.
So good. So good.
But we just laughed, just looking at each other in the starting gate. It was kind of surreal.
Yeah.
You know, because we both want to be jockey and you never know where your life is going to take you. And it's not like we're I'm quite a few years older than him. So when I start riding, he was much younger. So I never knew that we're really going to be in a race together and stuff like that, you know, so it was pretty funny.
What about your uncle, Alan? I know he trains, but he also rides too, doesn't
yes.
he? And he'll ride his own horses.
Yes.
That he trains. Have you ridden with him?
Yes, I've ridden with him. And before I came to, when I was in Gulfstream, he ran two horses one day. And he put me on both horses to ride, which, you know, it's pretty good. I ride for him sometimes and I'm there. And I rode two horses for him and he saddled both. And the first one finished second and the second one won. And two races later, he rode for a different trainer.
Oh, come on.
So, yeah. But, yeah.
It's funny. So you won your third race of your life for your father, actually. Is that correct?
No. No, not for my father.
No, did you have you won for your father?
Yeah, I won. Yeah? I won many races for my father, but it wasn't the third race. I rode the first horse I ever rode in my life. My mom owned the horse.
Okay.
My dad trained him, and the horse's name was Mr. Rajiv.
Okay.
My namesake. That was my first ever mount.
That's great.
Yeah, that was
That's
my first
too
ever
funny.
Mount.
Was that a lot of pressure?
No, it wasn't any pressure because I wasn't really forced to win. They just wanted to get me in a race, and it was a very great moment in my life and for my family and everything. Just the first time riding, and there wasn't really any pressure because we weren't really expected to win.
Sure.
Finish fifth, and it was fun.
For sure, and so you started actually riding at Tampa. Yes.
Well, my first few mounts were at Gulfstream, at Calder in December of 2003. And after I rode a few mounts at Calder, they were kind of spaced out. The first one was a few weeks before the second one and then the third one. Then I went to Tampa because at that time now the Gulfstream, when the meet was starting in January, and it was very strong meet. I wasn't going to be able to ride anything there for a few months. So I went to Tampa with the intention to get experience riding, just starting out really, you know, from the bottom, and just to try to get comfortable riding and learn whatever rides. And that's when I went to Tampa.
What do you remember about the first time you actually went into the starting gate for a live race?
Okay, so the first time I rode, this is exactly what I remember. The gate opened and the race was over.
Yes.
It was so fast. The gate opened and I didn't even know one thing that happened. It went boom, boom, over.
Were you expecting it to be? You weren't expecting it to be that fast.
I really didn't know what to expect. But when the gate opened and I don't remember one thing happening in the race. I just remember the race was over.
No, it's so true. As you continue to ride, things start to slow down and you know exactly what you're doing.
It's like a football player, right? We hear that about quarterbacks all the time when they get drafted from college and go into the NFL. The game is moving so fast because it's such a different level. And then as they get more experience, it slows down. Same thing for a jockey, right?
Yeah, well, definitely. I didn't know that about football players, but I guess it can relate to that for sure. And yeah, that was definitely true. It slows down a lot after you start riding and stuff. But it's remarkable. The first race was just a blur.
Was it better the second time?
Not much, but a little, yeah.
I have that same kind of memory, Rajiv.
Right?
And I also started riding at Tampa, and Tampa is tough. It brings in a lot of riders because of the weather, of course. And so how did you like that meet there?
Well, I went into that meet. My beginning of my career or my riding was different because my father, he's pretty knowledgeable about the sport, and he's the one that got me starting to ride, to train me to be a jockey. And when I started riding was only a few months after I graduated high school. It was really fast. I would just gallop and started breezing, and then I started riding with the intention of just to get in races and practice. My dad didn't want me to win my first five races, because after your fifth race you have 1 year until then for your apprenticeship. He wanted me to get polished up in races before, so he didn't really want me to win. So what happened was I just went there with the intention to ride horses, not with the intention to win, but with intention to practice and train and try to develop to learn how to ride. That was my dad's intention for me. So that was the mindset that I went in there with. Naturally, you always want to win your first race or whatever, because it could get frustrating if you were to ride a lot of horses and not win. But, you know, the goal was always to try to make riding a career instead of just a quick come out and ride and win a few races, and after the bug, you're not polished, and then you can't take it to another level to compete as a jockey.
Sure.
So that was one of the biggest things that my dad kept telling me when I'm starting to ride and going into being a jockey.
How much would he teach you about riding and the fundamentals? Was that a big part of what he did with you?
Oh, yeah. In being a jockey or an apprentice, the hardest thing is starting. The hardest thing is learning the basics. The rest can come after. But just the foundation to be a jockey is pretty tough, to learn the balance and to be comfortable on the horse, to be able to be in control of the horse and get your strength and your balance. That is very hard. Just learning the first steps. It's pretty tough. But after that, and you start riding, everything starts coming easier and easier.
What kind of teacher was your dad?
Pretty tough. You know, he's tough. He has his way and he kind of enforces it. So for you, if you believe in him, which I did and I do, so I try to follow his curriculum as best as I could and try to stick. Because I'll give you a funny story. I'm there and he has me in the shed row, walking around a horse, just learning how to steer the horse by the horse walking. And I'm doing that for quite a while I was going to a farm and riding. I rented a pony to learn to ride, because the racehorses on the track is pretty tough to learn off racehorses. So I was riding the pony at the farm to learn how to trot the horse and stuff. But at the track, I wasn't going on the track. I was just staying in the shed row. I had the license to be able to go on the track. And my dad said, no, you're not ready. He had me in there for about 2 months.
Wow.
And I'm like, listen, man, I'm ready. I'm telling you, I'm ready. And he kept telling me, no, you're not. If this horse goes on the track and takes off running or something. And to me, I'm thinking, this is easy. This is a piece of cake. So the first horse I go on the track, he said, okay, you want to go on the track? Go on the track. He said, jog him once a run. It was a training track at Calder. And it's like a 3/8 mile track. Maybe not even that big. Small track. And every horse goes the right way. So I'm jogging the horse. I'm supposed to jog him one turn. I go a half a turn. A couple horses gallop by me. He broke off like he came out the gate. Running 100 miles an hour. So now, I can't stop him, of course. The outrider ran out on the track and grabbed me. Pulled me up. She looks over to me and she says, 6 months, I don't want to see you back on the track. I was like, yeah.
Valuable lesson.
That was my first time on the track.
Do you remember that moment specifically? I know at the jockey school, sometimes these kids get run off with, and that's when you know if they're going to make it or they're not, because they're scared to go too fast. Was that something that where you'd like, oh, this is cool, but other than you couldn't stop?
Well, yeah, I wasn't thinking of it like that, because I had my mindset that I'm going to be a jockey, but I was trying to stop him and I couldn't, so I kind of felt like a little helpless, hopeless. And but the next day, I went to the training center because I had the license, but she told me she don't want to see me on the track. And I got a horse to ride. The guy had a horse over there, a trainer had one horse, and I was like, I want to get on the horse. I wanted to get on. The horse dropped me like 8 times. He dropped me and stood there. And I had to catch him, pull him back for someone to leg me up. This is a training center right next to Calder. They call Vietnam.
Right.
And every time I got on him, he'll run about 3 jumps and just drop me. Yeah.
And you still wanted to be a jockey.
And I still kept on riding him.
After all that.
I kept on riding him.
Will you still call your dad and ask him for advice or ask him what he thought about your performance in certain races to this day?
Yeah, most of the times I don't call him. He calls me. Hey, what were you doing? Oh, yeah. He's tough like that, yeah. Tiger Woods needs a coach. He uses a coach. He's one of the greatest golfers ever.
Yeah.
I think, you know, jockeys surely do. And you have to be able to take some constructive criticism. And, you know, anybody that tells you when you do bad, sometimes it might sound harsh, but it's people that really care for you to do better, because they wouldn't tell you. Yeah. If they didn't care. So, you know, sometimes it might come off as hard, but if you listen and you take the good out of it and you can run with that, you can make yourself better. Because in this business and being a jockey, every day you're in a scenario that's a new scenario. Even if you've ridden 10,000 races and you're going to approach it different, but sometimes you make mistakes, sometimes not, but you're going to learn and you're always going to learn. You learn something new every single day, every time you get on a horse. So if somebody like my dad was, he helps me a lot by telling me what he thinks that I did wrong or not.
Real quick, Rajiv, we're about to go to commercial break, but were there any other mentors that helped you along in the jockstream?
Yeah, it's such a great jockey family, the way jockeys live with each other. Even though we're competing against each other, every day there'll be someone that you're competing against that will try to tell you something to make you better. And a lot of jockeys along the line, I'd say instead of naming jockeys, I would say maybe 90% of the jockeys, out of 10 jockeys, 9 of them will say something to me or another jockey to help them. And so will I say to another jockey if I think something as well. But most of the older riders, that the circuits that I've been on with the New York circuit and the Florida circuit, some of the best, greatest riders ever. And they're always willing to help the younger guys to make them better.
Most definitely, because they're out there too, and they want you to be able to control your horse for their safety and everyone else's safety.
Yes, that as well, in the safety part of it, but also in like a skill part of it too. They'll help you. John Velasquez, if I were to say, what do you think about the way I sit on this horse? He'll give me his perspective and try to help me, just to name one jockey. But there's almost all the jockeys, they're willing to give you any advice if you're willing to listen.
When you go to the Jockeys Guild website, there are certain questions that each jockey has to answer. And one of those is your role model when you're growing up. And John Velasquez is the one that Rajiv lists as your role model. And it's got to be quite a thrill to be in the jocks room with him every day.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And Johnny is a kind of a role model, not only on the track, but off the track, because he's one of the true successes of jockeys. And the way he carries himself and everything, you can't say anything bad about him. And also, Jerry Bailey has been very instrumental to me since I started riding. He's helped me along the way in many ways. And those two guys are two of the greatest jockeys. And I was fortunate to be around them. So I'm lucky to be in a jockey room with those guys and for them to help me and the other jockeys as well.
Go back to our website, listeners, and catch those previous episodes, one with John Velasquez. And we'll continue this episode after this quick commercial break with jockey Rajiv Miraj. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The Kentucky Derby runs here.
California Chrome shines bright in the Kentucky Derby.
Kentucky Derby 141, Saturday, May 2nd, exclusively on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word JOCKEY to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Xacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word JOCKEY to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
Hey, I'm Chantel Sutherland Cruz and want to tell you all about BetAmerica.com. It's the coolest place to bet on horse racing on over 200 racetracks from America and around the world. New players receive a 100% bonus on your first deposit, up to $300. That's the best sign-up bonus available today. It's time to play the BetAmerica way.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
The Charlestown Classic, live from Hollywood Casino at Charlestown Races.
It's Kaisha, Electronica, and Javier Castellano to win the Charlestown Classic. Game On Dude has won the Charlestown Classic in an absolute shocker. Imperative and Kent DeSormo have won the Charlestown Classic.
This Saturday, beginning at 4:30 p.m. Eastern, go to horseracingradio.net for channel information or to listen live.
Hi, this is Chris McCarron, and you're listening to the best horse racing show on the radio on Horse Racing Radio Network.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
They come to the top of the lane. Teddy's Promise on the inside. Groupie Dollar's right there. Dance Card to Grey on the outside. Sweet Lulu tries to hang tough along the inside as well. Groupie Doll hanging on. Judy the Beauty's come back at them as well. And Dance Card on the outside. But it's Groupie Doll. Groupie Doll, Dance Card, Judy the Beauty going to hit it together. Groupie Doll along the inside. Groupie Doll, Judy the Beauty. Groupie Doll in a thriller. Groupie Doll beats Judy the Beauty. Dance Card was third. Summer Applause running on late to be in a photo with Sweet Lulu for four.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm Christina McManigle with Mike Penna and jockey Rajiv Miraj. You just heard the replay of Groupie Doll's victory in the 2013 Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Sprint. We will touch on that here in a minute, Rajiv, but first of all, why don't we go back and let's talk about your transition from Florida to New York.
Yeah, so after I won about seven races, Angel Cordero, from when I won my third race in Gulfstream Park, he came up to my dad and me, and we started talking, and he liked the way I rode for a young rider, and he thought that for me to be a good rider, I would have to go to New York, and he was going to help me to build me up from where I was. So that spring, he called and he was asked if I was going to come to New York, and he's going to be my agent. And that's how I transitioned to New York in the spring of 2005, I believe it was.
Yeah.
No, 2004. Spring 2004. And it's a really tough meet. I was very skeptical about going there, obviously, at such a young age and not really knowing too many people there and not really having too much foundation of riding. I was only riding a couple months. And I thought, though, for Angel Cordero to approach me, that was a great opportunity of a lifetime. He's one of the biggest names in the sport, and he was going to help me. And at the time, John Velasquez was his jockey, and I was going to be his apprentice. And it was a risk, big risk at the time for me. When I went to New York, he really took me under his wing, mainly showing me how to ride on the equisizer, trying to get me stronger, and we watch a lot of replays, and I was pretty much going to his house every day. I wasn't riding a lot because I was still an apprentice, and it was such a strong meet with a lot of big name riders riding at the time. And I started riding there. I didn't really have too much success that spring. I won one race for the spring, but what I learned from riding with those jockeys at that point in my life, and what Angel taught me, you can't mimic that in any other way other than doing it. So it might have been a little step back for me, I thought at the time, but going longer, it was a big step forward. And after those few months in that spring, he told me, he said, you can go to Saratoga, because now the Belmont Spring Meet was over, or I can set you up with an agent. And I have quite a few friends in Monmouth Park, where it would be a good opportunity for you to go and be able to ride more horses with better chances and have a chance to win and stuff, and also develop more. So he called his friend, who is Joey D'Angelo, who unfortunately he passed away recently. The nicest guy, one of the nicest guys you'll meet. And he became my agent. And the first race I rode there, I finished second. But that was one of the moves that kind of transitioned my career big time, because I became, already the meet had started a few months in Monmouth, but it was a big change in my life right there, because I started having a good success there, and I started picking up a lot of winners, and now I started riding for a lot of people, and I'm getting great opportunities, and I was winning a lot of races at that time now, from winning no races or hardly any races. And that fall, I ended up being the leading apprentice in the Meadowlands, which at the time was another big step forward for me. And it was just I loved it in Jersey. And for a few years, that ended up being my circuit, where I would ride Jersey in the summer and Florida in the winter, or New York.
Yeah.
So it was a big step forward for me.
We're going to talk about so many of the top horses that you have had the privilege to be aboard, but I want to go back to something you just mentioned when you were struggling, when you first came to New York in that spring, and you said you won like one race, right?
Yes.
Was there ever a time, because it was such a big risk for you, that you said, boy, Angel, I don't know if I can do this. I need to get back to Florida. Did that moment ever occur, or did Angel not let you have that moment?
That moment didn't really occur. For one thing, I think because it was a short period of time.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I got to New York in about April, mid-April, or about May, and I won only one race, but it was a month and like 2 months I spent in New York, because then in July I went to Monmouth.
Right. Okay.
Maybe if it was over a longer span, then I would have been more desperate, I would say.
Sure, you get desperate, you want to win, but it was obviously such a good opportunity. But was there ever a time when you thought, I guess homesick maybe is a word to use, your family was all in Florida? Was that tough?
Yes, that was the toughest part of it, because I grew up in a very close-knit family, and New York was tough moving there and being a bit homesick for sure. I go from living in a big, beautiful house in Florida with my family to living in a basement, it wasn't a good lifestyle for me, that 2 months living conditions. But at the time, I had to do what I had to do. When I moved to Monmouth, I knew no one there. I didn't even know there was horse racing in New Jersey. That's the honest truth. I didn't know there was a Monmouth Park or anything. And I moved there, packed up my car, and went. And I ran into an old friend of my father who was a jockey. He rode race with my dad in Jamaica, and he was at Monmouth Park.
Wow.
Mike Redwood. So I saw him the first day I went there. I'm like, I don't even know. I have a place to stay. My car was packed up, and I don't know where to go, where to stay and stuff. But I was named on a horse. And Mike Redwood said, I'm renting a room in a house with another homeowner, and he has an empty room. No. Maybe I could come. You could stay there. I'm gonna talk to him tomorrow. Okay, perfect, Mike. So he told me the next day. I took his number and stuff, and he said, yeah, the guy said you could come stay here, and he told me the price and everything. I'm like, great. That's kind of working out good. It's a risk. Yeah, I don't know.
That's what I'm thinking. As you're telling this story, Rajiv, and listening to what we heard in the first half of the program too, the one thing I'm thinking is that Rajiv Miraj has never been afraid to take a risk in anything you've done along the way so far. Accurate?
I would say so, because at that point in my life, I'm a young guy and I don't have responsibilities. That's the thing. I don't have kids or a wife or anything. Yeah. So at that time, it's the time to do that.
Yeah.
Because even if I lost, if I turned out to be no career in horse racing, I could always do other stuff, but that was my first choice, my first goal. And that was always my plan. And I said with my family, we had good talks about this when I was graduating from high school. Instead of going to college, I kind of said, I'll give it 1 year in horse racing. If I don't seem to have a career, I was going to try something else. If I don't think I'm going to be able to make it as a jockey. That was one thing with my parents that we talked about. It was a discussion, family discussion.
When did you eventually end up meeting your now wife, Angie? Where did that come into the mix?
I had met her. I met her in 2004 in December.
Okay.
December 2004.
But you weren't married yet, so you still had plenty of leeway to take these risks and to do these types of things like going to Monmouth and being there and not having a room.
How about this is another risk then? Talk about Angie. So this is how I met Angie. She was living in Florida. I was living in New York at the time. I was talking to my cousin, and he says, hey, there's a beautiful girl here at the park that she came with my other cousin. They work at the bank together. You'd like her. I said, put her on the phone. Let me talk to her. I start talking to her. We're talking for 2 months. We don't know what each other looks like.
Come on. You never met her.
Never met her. So
she fell
talking
for the accent,
though,
right?
Yeah,
so
here's where the story gets good. She's going to be mad that I'm telling this story. But I'm talking to her for 2 months. We hit it off big time, right? So now my cousin is turning 16. It's her sweet 16 party. And I'm flying down for the night from New York for her birthday. And I'm flying back the next day to New York to ride. So I fly there. Angie was at the party. That's when I meet her. The first thing she says to me, you're not my type.
Well, that's a nice opening line.
Yeah, there's another risk I took.
She was wrong.
And then now we're married. Obviously. Now we're married. That was 11 years ago.
Wow, that's fantastic. What a story. She will be mad at you, by the way, for sure. You talked briefly about you were going to give it 1 year if you weren't successful. You're going to go back to school. Did you ever think what that would be if you didn't ride?
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough because one of the things that I would go to school for was a veterinarian. That was my kind of other. If I was to go to school, that was what I was going to focus on, trying to be a veterinarian. But with the discussion with my family was, well, you go to veterinarian, you got to go 8 years and then probably another 2 years, like 10 years of school before you actually start practicing, which in being a jockey, I had 1 year to figure out, well, maybe I'm going to be able to make a career or not out of it, because that was our plan. So it kind of was like, I can always fall back and being a veterinarian, but I can't go to school for 10 years as a veterinarian and then try to be a jockey at 30 right. years old. So that was kind of why I tried to go that route. And that was kind of why I started riding as soon as I did. The same year I graduated high school, I started riding races. I didn't try to polish up in the mornings for 2-3 years and like a lot of people do and go to a school for that amount of time and then try to ride, because it would have been hard to do that and then go ride and then find out that you're going to suck at being a jockey or you're not going to make a successful career out of it for whatever reason and then go back to school. So that was kind of things that with my family and I that we had to kind of discuss.
Do you see yourself going back to school eventually?
Not necessarily, but there is sometimes I do feel like I would focus on some stuff. Like they have kind of like different seminars and stuff like that in certain fields that I'm would be interested in, and if they had like crash courses on those kind of things, I would do it. But at the moment, it's being a jockey. You have to put, I put my whole life into being a jockey, so it's kind of hard to do much other stuff.
Jockey Rajiv Mirage joining us on the Horse Racing Radio Network, Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Rajiv, we talked about school, and you are obviously, from what I hear anyway, an avid handicapper. You always study your races, and during the break we were talking about your brother's so smart. So do you, obviously you like to study, and you're kind of, I guess, book smart in a way.
Yeah, in school I was always getting high grades in that respect, but handicapping is, not only is it fun to just, you know, looking at the races and stuff like that, and I grew up doing that being from a child, but also being a jockey, preparing yourself for the races, I think it's very important to analyze the races and go out there with a kind of an idea of what to expect, or it's basically doing your homework and taking care of your business. That's what that is for me.
And you'll do that for every race you ride?
Oh yeah, yeah.
What's that preparation like for you? You mentioned handicapping, but what does that entail?
One thing that I'm fortunate to be in these jockeys room, that they have this technology where they show replays machines. I think that's a big thing for me, honestly. Like the replays, a lot of thing is not necessarily what's going to happen in the race, but you can get a good idea of a horse that you're going to ride if you've never ridden the horse before. By looking at the paper tells you some things by handicapping the paper, but watching their video replays give you a very in-depth idea of the kind of horse that you're riding.
What are you watching for?
It depends on the horse, but you're going to watch. When you watch the horse, for me, I pick up a lot by watching a previous race of a horse, kind of his tendencies, his style, what he likes and what he doesn't like. And sometimes you don't see that on the paper as much as you would actually visually watching the horse run. And I think that's a big key for me, replays. I love watching replays. A lot of times, even with horses that comes from a different country that I've never seen run, in like Europe and France and all those foreign countries, I actually go on YouTube and try to dig up their races. And a lot of times I find races, and it gives me a good idea of what to expect with a horse that really I haven't ridden or haven't seen run.
That hard work pays off, Rajiv. And you talk about a horse's running style. Do you have a preference as far as a horse to ride, as far as a speed horse or a horse that comes a closer?
I don't have any preference.
A winner.
I don't really have
a winner.
Any
winner.
Just a winner. Yes. I would say one thing, you need luck, and leaving the starting gate is very important in the races. And if you're on most speed horses, if they don't break as well for whatever reason, they can have their chances eliminated to win just by not breaking. And with a closer or a horse that doesn't need to be up there, then, you know, it give you a little more option. So maybe you'd have to choose a horse with a little more option who can overcome some adversity. Those are the best horses to ride.
Let's talk about some of the horses that have overcome adversity for you, and they've done it on the big stage. Your first graded stakes win comes in 2005 in the Hurricane Birdie with a horse named Lila. And then you come back with your first grade one victory right here in the Bluegrass at Keeneland in the Ashland Stakes with Little Bell for Saeed Bin Soror and Godolphin. And I know that for you had to be a very special moment. And when you go back to the Guild's website, that's one of your greatest achievements, is winning that Ashland Stakes. Tell me about that day.
Well, Little Bell was trained at that time by Karen McLaughlin. Then Saeed had her after. But when I rode her, okay. Karen McLaughlin trained.
Gotcha.
And going into that race, I've never won a grade one, obviously, and that's a big stage. And it was my first ever race at Keeneland. So it was something that I was really looking forward to, just to be able to ride here and stuff. And then to win that race was like over the top. It was just such a monumental day in my life, and something that I definitely will never forget.
So. Is that a moment where you say, you know what, I can actually do this? All those risks I took, they're all coming together now, and I can be successful at this.
I probably never looked at it like that. Now that we're talking about it, I'm starting to realize, yeah, I might have been a little stupid taking all these loans. I always thought I was a conservative person, but now when I'm really thinking out loud here talking, I'm like, man. But I just thought all my life growing up, all my dreams, I would go to bed at night as a young child and just dream of winning these races. And it was just like a picture in my it was almost like it was real. Like I was riding these races and I was really winning these races and I'm beating these big name jockeys or whatever. That was my childhood growing up. Every single night I can remember, that's what I dreamt about. Riding races and winning these big races and whatever. It's 100% literally a dream come true, winning these big races, because that's really what I dreamt about every night.
Well, you have to really think about, wow, it all paid off whenever you had your first Breeders' Cup victory. Tell us about that.
So when I was a teenager growing up, and I always said, I want to win a Breeders' Cup race. I want to ride in the Breeders' Cup. That was always my dream. People talk about the Kentucky Derby, and I love the Kentucky. I'm glad to be a part of it. The Breeders' Cup was a bigger deal for me personally.
Really?
For me personally, that was a bigger deal for me.
How come?
Honestly. It was just something that I was fascinated with. I was fascinated with the Breeders' Cup. So I always said, I will never, before I start riding as a teenager, I will never go to the Breeders' Cup to watch the races live at the Breeders' Cup if I wasn't riding in the race. I said that. And then the Breeders' Cup came to Gulfstream. Now I'm living in Florida. So I go to the track every day. And I didn't go for the Breeders' Cup.
Really?
Really?
Didn't go. All my family, everyone went. I didn't go. I said, I'm not ever going until I'm riding in the Breeders' Cup. Wow. So now I ended up winning the first year I rode in the Breeders' Cup, I had a lot of great chances and it didn't pan out. And I would say that was one of the biggest disappointments for me. I started overlooking the fact that my dream was always just to ride in the Breeders' Cup. Now I was disappointed I didn't win because I had a lot of high profile horses with chances and stuff. And I was so disappointed. And then the next year, Breeders' Cup was 2 days, Friday and Saturday. And the Friday, I rode a lot of nice chances, finished third and fourth. And I had 5 mounts on Friday, 4 or 5. And on Saturday, I only had 1 Breeders' Cup mount. And I was like, after the Friday night, I was so done. It's like they deflated every air out of a tire. That's what I felt like,
yeah.
A deflated tire. And I was like, down, down, down. And my only mount was Caleb's Posse on Saturday at Churchill. And sure enough, he ran by the field and went by 5 lengths. And it was such a big relief for me. It was, again, another dream come true. So,
How'd you celebrate?
Celebrate. I had to fly back to New York to ride the next day. So we just kind of didn't really do celebrate, but it was just for my life. It's like something off my bucket list.
Yeah. That was the start of something special because it was the first of 4 Breeders' Cup victories that you've been part of. Of course, Hightail would give you another one in the juvenile sprint, and then the great Groupie Doll, who was just unbelievable.
Yeah, Groupie Doll is just a one of a kind, you know. She's just special, as good as they get. And for that whole thing with Groupie Doll was so amazing and so much fun. Not only because she was such a great filly to be affiliated with and everything and be able to ride. And she was going to go down in the history books as a great filly. Mm-hmm. Also, her connections, the owners and trainers. They're deserving of every success that they have because they're the nicest people. And every time I rode that filly, as good as she was, there was never any pressure. It was always just a team with Buff Bradley and all the owners and stuff. It was just a great team effort. I just felt like a part of the team of Groupie Doll all the time. And it was, that made it even more special. It goes back to being not about a business, but about the sport.
Yeah.
Which is really why I am involved in being a jockey. You know, that's the primary thing for me as a jockey, is the fun and the sport of it.
Yeah, well said. And you won't find better people than Buff Bradley and his dad and that entire team surrounding Groupie Doll. They were first class start to finish.
What was she like to ride?
She was amazing. And her personality, her demeanor was when you see her in the paddock, you wouldn't believe that that's Goupil. She was so laid back, didn't care about anything, almost like she was just a quiet, chill filly, didn't do anything wrong. The first few times I rode her, the first time I rode her, she didn't run with blinkers, and I had worked her in the morning, and she worked so sharp, like fast. And I was like, oh my God, this is a Breeders' Cup winner right here. And so I ride her the first time, and the gate opened, and she was just sleeping on me. She was like 8-10 lengths behind and wouldn't go. And I was like, oh my God, this isn't the same. And then she came flying and finished third by one length. But I knew she had lost the race in that early part of the race. She wasn't really into the bridling stuff because she was so quiet, so chill. So I didn't expect that because of how she worked prior to the race, a lot more sharp. And that's when put blinkers on her, both put the blinkers on her, and I went to ride her, and I started like tapping her on the shoulder, going into the gate to get her attention. She wouldn't move a muscle.
Wow.
She would stand in the gate every time. She wouldn't move a muscle. I'm like, oh my God, she's going to break slow. So, she would, and then I hustle her from the gate, and then she just takes off running like 100 miles an hour. But she was just so quiet.
I wish we had another hour with Raji, but we're coming up on the end of the program. Only about 4 minutes left. We haven't even touched on the four Kentucky Derbies that you've been part of. The first one with Mission Impossible in 2010. And then last year, that great story surrounding Wicked Strong. And I know you would have loved to have pulled that one off for the connections and everything that Wicked Strong was running for.
Oh, yeah. Wicked Strong with the whole Boston Marathon bombing and everything. I really felt like Wicked Strong had the support of the whole Boston area, and it would have been a very special day for everyone involved with that horse. And it's just a horse racing. Sometimes you want to win them all, and unfortunately he didn't win, but everyone was still proud of him, including all the people that support him.
Well, and what you both come back from with the terrible spill at Belmont.
Yeah, well, it's so just a part of horse racing. Sometimes things don't go your way and stuff, but we're both fortunate to be able to keep doing it, me and the horse. So it's just a little step back, but worked out pretty good.
Part of this show, part of the sponsorship from this show, we give back to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund, and people can go to pdjf.org to learn more. It's the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, and we encourage you to do so. And Rajiv, I know that you're very active at all the PDJF events and a big believer and supporter in what PDJF stands for.
Yeah, and people that don't really, not too sure exactly what it is for. Permanent Disabled Jockey Fund is for the jockeys that have been injured riding horses. And they can't make, it's a big help for them to be able to have everyone's support to get through life now, because it's not easy. Not easy for those guys. And the more hands come together to help them, it's always a benefit.
Well, they gave everything. And for us to be able to help them, that's the least we can do.
That's for sure.
Rajiv, I always like to wrap up by asking guests what they like to do outside of horse racing. I know fishing, poker, a couple of your other interests, and basketball too, right?
Yeah, well, I quit playing basketball. Because
when you got cut by the Miami Heat.
Yeah, when I get cut by I quit the Miami Heat.
They stole that line from Joe Bravo.
I
stole it from Joe Bravo last week.
Yeah. But definitely I love playing poker and also fishing. Yeah, fishing. There's two things that I do when I'm doing that, my head is clear. That's all I focus on. And you know, other than horse racing, it just captivates my whole life. So
remember a few weeks ago, Sean Bridgemahan was here, another native of Jamaica, and we played that rap song that he's mentioned in. Well, Rajiv, he told me, he said, Rajiv is, he's a great rider, but he doesn't have a rap song about him.
I just, when I win a Kentucky Derby, hopefully, they'll make a reggae song after that. Then I'll be like, you keep your rap song. I'll with my reggae music.
Irie, man. Absolutely. Rajiv Mirage here on Jock Talk.
Thank you so much for joining us in studio, Rajiv.
All right. Thanks for having me. It's a great, great afternoon.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And of course, support the PDJF, right? PDJF.org. And
donate.
Check out the podcast. There's going to be a lot of people that didn't hear this show live. They can go back and listen on our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes as well.
check it out, guys.
Yeah, make sure you do that. And follow us on social media, at HRN on Twitter, right?
Another way to
get a hold of us.
Don't miss it, and tune in next week.
Yeah, can't wait. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Reggie. You've been fun, my friend.
All right, thank you, guys. Yeah.
Of course, for our producer, Mr. Delapina, doing a great job here, and Christina McManigal. We'll talk to you next time on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.